strategy. Poland's public spending as a share of GDP was 40% of GDP, higher than the United States, with publicly financed health, education, family leave, pensions, and so forth. Of course, to say that the transition was easy would not be right, because there was a moribund, collapsed industrial Soviet economy, where the technologies were second rate and ended up, of course, being unable to compete. The restructuring of these economies depended on technological upgrading, largely to incorporate them in the German industrial system, which is largely, though not exclusively, machine building and automotive. And the countries of Central Europe, that is Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, Croatia, are engaged as suppliers of largely the German automotive and industrial system, and they've had a significant rise of living standards as a result of this. Ending socialism was no simple piece of cake. This was a failed, bankrupt, rusted out, cynical, corrupt, violent system. So I can't say that everything was easy and smooth, but the basic ideas were to return to Europe. Then countries could have their own normal politics after that. There were two places that actually, everything depends on geography, which I think is usually poorly understood. But the states that were closest to Western Europe did the best, and Poland did the best of all. And Poland's transformation is absolutely incomparable to anything that Poland achieved in any other 25 years of its history from 1600 onward. So Poland had the vast benefit of the Pomeranian Plain, the strong connections with Germany, a good policy, the Pope, and timely development assistance. Hungary did less well, but these are very idiosyncratic issues that would take us too far afield to discuss right now. The Czech Republic and Slovakia have done very well. Slovenia and Croatia have done well. So what are the big challenges? The farther you go east, the harder this transformation is, because the essence of the transformation is incorporation of economies into the Western European economic space. So Bulgaria and Romania have a harder time. The countries that are not members of the European Union have a much harder time, because they lose the foreign investment and they lose the benefits of trade. The division of Yugoslavia was, in my opinion, an unnecessary tragedy. I was involved in Yugoslavia in 1989 to 1991. But whatever it is, whether its dissolution was avoidable, desirable, of course, people can differ on that, nationalists do differ on that. When countries break up, it's hard. When they go to war, it's harder. And when the West divides the countries between Catholicism and Orthodoxy, which is basically what happened, then you end up with a division of results. So Serbia was on the outside, Slovenia and Croatia on the inside. The difference of performance between Croatia and Slovenia on one side as EU members, NATO members, and Serbia on the outside is a very notable point. There's no deep reason for it except geopolitics. Romania and Bulgaria were much poorer, farther away, and therefore a lot of the transformation was more difficult. Then turn to the Soviet Union. This is a completely different case. This is largely the Soviet Empire, except the Russian Empire, except for the Baltic states, which were incorporated into the Russian Empire late. The Baltic states broke out. They're small. They were able to become part of the Scandinavian-German economic space. They've done on the floor quite well with lots of issues, especially of mixed ethnicity, the Russian population. But basically, the Baltic states stand out. But if you look at the heartland of the Russian Empire, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, and onward to the east, this is a completely different case. And the reason is that the benefits of incorporation into the European space don't apply. This is not a matter of joining Europe. This is a region too far away. It was not welcomed in the European Union. It was kept on the other side of NATO. And in my opinion, the United States deeply blew it in foreign policy, because basically the idea of U.S. foreign policy was to move the NATO border 1,000 miles to the east rather than to incorporate Russia into a common home, which was Gorbachev's vision. I'm a great fan of Mikhail Gorbachev. I think he's the greatest statesman of our age. I think the peaceful end of the Soviet Union depends on him, not on Reagan. I have a lot of evidence for that. It's a long story. But the United States duped Gorbachev, treated him like shit, treated Russia like shit, and ended up with a new divide. But that was really part of the goal of all of this. So I'm going to stop there because I want to have a few minutes for discussion. But I want to say that most of our narratives about these issues, you know, Sachs was a neoliberal. This is just so stupid. It's such a low level of understanding. What was happening was geopolitical. What was happening was reincorporating Central and Eastern Europe into the European space. What was happening was that the United States decided that it was the victor of the Cold War, not the end of the Cold War. So the United States wanted to extend and expand NATO to create the U.S. hegemony and primacy. This remains a disaster. Our U.S. foreign policy is disastrous. We don't know how to be peaceful. We just know how to make war. We just have a military approach to issues. And on the social dimensions, the basic theory of economics is the more you give money to people in need, the better off they are, full stop. Everything else is the pedantic nonsense of our academia, I'm going to say. If we wanted to help more, we would have had a Marshall Plan. Of course, I spent years arguing for it. The only aid that materialized was for Eastern Europe, Poland, basically. The only reason that that materialized was geopolitical. The United States didn't care about anything except geopolitics in these years. The idea that you help people in need was absolutely beyond the capacity of our foreign policy. So the help for Russia never materialized. We blew it, and I turn it back over to you. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. That was very strongly stated, very nice. I'm sure there's a couple reactions. You want to ask a question?
He's absolutely right.
So would anyone like to ask a question, or are we okay? So maybe I'll ask one question, which is that, you know, I appreciate a lot of what you said, and especially about the difference between Central Europe and the former Soviet Union. But I wonder in retrospect if, as you said, the policies were geared towards getting a country like Poland back into Europe, and those policies were anyway going to be inapplicable to Russia and the former Soviet Union, should we not have advocated some different policies for those countries which simply weren't going to get into Europe?
Well, you know, what were the policies? We might have recommended the continued domination of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union.
For instance.
That was the Chinese approach. I don't understand the different policies. The policies that I advocated was to incorporate Russia into the world economy in a peaceful, decent way. We rejected that idea. That's it. You know, but what Russia could have done on its own, if you were in Russia in 1989 to 1994, as I was, it was a rust zone. It was a collapsed empire based on a terrible idea. People were living in urban areas. It was not Chinese peasants. It was Russian, urban, heavy industrialization, polluted, dead environment with technologies that were 10 to 20 years behind the West. And what Russia needed was German technology, U.S. technology, partnership, help to cushion the social situation, but not the maintenance, in my opinion, of an authoritarian state to hold an empire together. By the way, one thing you really should appreciate is that when you go from one country to 15 countries, you blow apart the trading system. So it's not even standing still. And the IMF was completely incompetent in this. I recommended a quick move to currencies for these 15 countries so that they could trade with each other. The IMF insisted on keeping the Soviet ruble in a locked account that prevented trade even across the republics, you know, the new independent mm-hmm. countries. So it's a long issue. I'd be happy to sit for hours with you to explain my perception of what the real choices were in 1991. But I think I tactically had the right idea, which was to help Gorbachev achieve his vision and to help Yeltsin achieve his vision of a normal Russia. But the United States didn't play along. That's my biggest disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration was at an end. The Clinton administration was brain dead from the start in terms of really understanding what it was about. Clinton was a domestic president. It's the economy stupid, but it was actually geopolitics stupid. And we blew it.
Johannes and Mikhail.
Jeffrey, can you hear me? This is Johannes Lind. You may remember me from World Bank days. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Hi, Johannes.
Hi. So you won't be surprised to hear that I agree with just everything you say, and I'm really grateful you're here to talk to us. I have one sort of question as perhaps a devil's advocate, if you wish. But, you know, the West Germans paid to the East Germany on the order of $100 billion a year, which is about as much as owed on an annual basis. And, of course, the EU is importing huge amounts of money into the Eastern members, but even also beyond that, even before membership. Despite it all, you know, you still have in East Germany now an AfD growing in importance because there's a lot of resentment about non-financial, non-economic aspects of the transition. And of course, you have the reaction currently in Eastern Europe, very unhappy about many aspects of the EU. So I'm just wondering, how does that play into your vision about the Marshall Plan for Central and Eastern Europe, for Russia and so on? Would a Marshall Plan have really been the answer, or is it actually a lot of the other stuff that geopolitical and sort of being much more open and expanding NATO? And so it's really a bigger picture that is much more important than just the financial aspects of a Marshall Plan. Thank you.
Yeah, Johannes, a great question. I was just in East Germany a couple of weeks ago. Of course, it's Germany. It is a well-functioning economy. East Berlin was humming with young hipsters. And it's true that there's sociology in addition to economics. There's the same kind of politics we have in the United States. Trump is our AfD. You know, we have a psychopathic president that has the support of 35 to 40% of the country. So politics goes beyond this, but it's just a lot worse when the economy suffers also, because then the fascists arguments are even more resonant. So I don't think Germany's going to go the way of AfD unless we have another disaster like the 1930s. But you're right that probably resentment in the former Soviet Union, not in the former Soviet Union, I would say in Russia, would have been high anyway. But the way to overcome resentment is at least by making a show of trying to be helpful. And the United States did not. And Putin's argument basically is, look, you tried to surround me with NATO, you brought NATO to the Baltics, you brought NATO to the Black Sea, then you wanted to bring NATO to Ukraine, you wanted to bring NATO to Georgia. Stop it! And that's, I agree with Putin, by the way, on that. I don't agree with Putin on a lot of other things, but I agree with Putin on the argument that the U.S. policy is to surround Russia with NATO. I just couldn't believe we offered NATO to Georgia in the Caucasus. Are you kidding? What are we trying to do? It's still World War III? Instead, we got a short Georgian war. And we got a divided Ukraine by the invitation of Ukraine to join NATO. So I think, you know, your observation is a very, very astute one. There's no guarantee in life. Even look at how the U.S. and U.K. Democratic systems are falling apart right now. The tensions of the modern age, which we don't fully understand, whether it's the social media alone, whether it's the depopulation of rural areas, whether it's the rate of change that leads to anomy in sociological terms, whether it's the rising inequality of corrupt political systems, it's probably a bit of all of those. But I would go with one more thing. Foreign policy should be nice to people that you want to deal with in the future. And we were not nice. And I watched it close up. We were nasty.
Mikko.
By the way, Clinton wasn't nasty. He was just dumb. He didn't understand what was happening. He was inexperienced. A governor of Arkansas was not equipped to deal with the transformation ahead. George Bush was attacked in 1992 from the right, if you remember, from Buchanan. And so even though Baker was telling them we got to help Russia, the White House decided politically that they wouldn't help Russia. This was explained to me after the fact. And we poisoned things more. The poison would have been there anyway to some extent. Nationalism, resentment, populism are part of our age. But we made it worse.
Yeah. Mikhail Lokshin wants to give a question.
I have a question. Could you please comment on the Joe Stiglitz approach, who advocates more gradual transition with building institutions first? And more or less, how I understand him, he's advocating the China way. So the way for Russia, for Soviet Union, was not a Marshall Plan, but was more kind of controlled gradual transition to similar to what China did.
Oh my gosh. Russia was 90% urban, industrial, bankrupt in 1991. China was 80% peasant. China's transformation was absolutely radical. 700 million peasants left the communes basically overnight in 1979 to 1981. But it was a peasant society. And so it was in development. Russia was in collapse. Russia was an empire that collapsed. Did Joe Stiglitz want to keep the Soviet empire together? Okay. Well, you know, I actually supported Gorbachev, keep the Soviet Union, democratize it, and help with the transformation. That was rejected by the West. But what is, I don't know what Stiglitz is talking about. It's just the comfort of academia, frankly, in this case. It wasn't the speed, it was the collapse that one has to understand. You know, it's like going back to 1919 in Germany and blaming the Weimar Republic. It was the Versailles Treaty. It was the military. It was the occupation of the Ruhr Valley. It was the reparations. It was the onset of the Depression. Let's look at some bigger factors at play here and try to understand it. 15 new countries blowing up the old empire, which I think is arguably the right thing to do, but then not having the basis. You're going to go gradual with the dissolution of the empire. How are you going to trade? How are you going to have people survive? What's going to happen when industrial production collapses 60%? You think gradualism is going to not have that happen when the Soviet Union runs out of all foreign exchange and has no international credits? I don't think that these are serious discussions, actually, this kind of debate. I think that they are beside the point. And I would note, since I was advisor of two quick transformations, anything Joe says about Poland, or would say, doesn't apply at all. So that Poland was fast. The issue isn't fast or slow. The issue is geography, history, geopolitics, starting position. It's a completely different set of categories.
Linda, do you want to make a quick...
Just quickly, since foreign policy came up, Linda Cook, I knew you a little bit at Harvard ages ago.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you if you could speak.
Yeah, you have to yell.
The microphone.
Yeah. Oh, this is my... Oh, sorry. Okay, so I, since foreign policy came up, I just want to ask your opinion about something. I agree with everything you said, but given where we are now, do you think that neutrality would be the best alternative for Ukraine? The idea has been floated by foreign policy people from Russia.
Yes, 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 yes. Ukraine should be Austria and Finland. It should be demilitarized. It should be made peaceful. And it should not be NATO, for God's sake.
Yes. Okay.
And what about the EU?
What about the EU?
Yeah, I mean, because they were trying to join the EU, not NATO, right, at that time.
If we had a decent policy for Russia as well, I'd be happy to see the EU consider Ukraine membership over the next 10 or 15 years. But what we really need is a geopolitics for Eurasia more broadly, because the jigsaw pieces are much more complicated than the EU when you talk about the 11 time zones of Russia. But you can't move with Ukraine without having some strategy that is broader, vis-a-vis China, vis-a-vis Central Asia, vis-a-vis Russia. And so I'm a believer in Eurasian integration. I think Belt and Road, the Shanghai Cooperative Organization, the new trade agreement that was just reached between China, Japan, Korea, ASEAN and Oceania, and a cooperative agreement between the EU, Russia, and China would put the pieces in place for peace and for economic integration. And I would love to see the sanctions against Russia come off. I believe that we should not extend NATO any further. And I think we should try to find a new architecture for Eurasia. But I think it will be Europe, China, Russia, India, ASEAN, the Gulf, that need to do most of the lifting, not the United States.
Okay. Do you want to make a comment? Yeah, no. Kristen, go ahead.
I'm going to have to run. Okay. I've really run out of time. I'm grateful for the chance to brainstorm. I'm so sorry my time is so limited, but they're picking me up very early for a meeting here. So
okay.
I'm running. But if we could continue, I would be absolutely delighted to continue the discussion with any and all.
Okay, well, we'll see if we can find a time for that. So thank you very much for your intervention here. We appreciate your very clear way of speaking and definitely leaving us with something to think about. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Excellent.
Thank you.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. Okay, well, that